Thank you for all being the stalwarts who are still here in the last morning of the conference. I really appreciate it. So this is going to be a little bit different because somehow you got an ethicist on this panel. So I'm actually not going to talk about sort of research of a particular program that I did, but I used to work with migrant farm workers. I spent many years working with community migrant farm worker health centers in Colorado and did a lot of work with farm workers. And at some point got really interested in ethics and went back to school and studied ethics and health policy. So I'm sort of, that's sort of my main world now, and I teach at Wellesley College, but I'm sort of bringing this experience that I had and with these women to bear here. So I want to start, I guess I actually have to do a, let's see, no personal relationships disclosure on here. I'm going to start with a story. Imagine the summer of 1978 in rural Colorado. Luce was 14 years old, working the melon fields, and I want to back up, thank you, and pregnant. Her abortion may be read as proof of successful access to legal abortion services, especially for a young, low-income Latina of unknown immigration status, or it may be read as evidence of failed access to comprehensive reproductive health services, including contraception and health education. Alternatively, when understood through the lens of reproductive justice, Luce's story reveals the breadth of fundamental economic, political, social inequities that compromised her reproductive health then and that continue to compromise farmworker women's health today. So just a bit about farmworkers. About between 4 and 5 farmworkers today in the U.S. is female. Reliable demographics about migrant farm workers are scarce, and much of the data we do have focuses on California, where the migrant population appears to be coming a little more female than the rest of the country, 27% of the population versus 21% nationally, more Mexican, closer to 100% versus 83% nationally, and more indigenous persons from Mexico, the farm worker population in California being 16 to 20%, but not true across the country. About 1 in 5 farmworker women travel solo on their own for work. 2/3 are married, and most of those who have a spouse and or children live with them. Most farmworkers live in families with mixed immigration statuses, are low income, and most of them live below the poverty line. Just a brief sketch of who they are. Now, data specific to farmworker women's reproductive health is even far more scarce. But what we do know suggests a morally and medically troubling landscape. I'm just going to say a little bit about a study that was done with migrant women in Colorado in 87, found that of sexually active women, 24% had been sterilized, 1/3 had had 1 or more miscarriages or abortions, and 1 in 8 had had an infant die in the first year of life. Now, farmworker women have long expressed their concerns about reproductive health. 20 years ago, in hearings with the National Council on Migrant Health, women testified that, 1, their physical labor and exposures to pesticides were putting their pregnancies at risk. 2, that healthcare services, including family planning, pregnancy care, and mental health services were difficult to obtain, especially if they were undocumented. And 3, they were experiencing gender discrimination and sexual violence. None of this is new, right? But despite numerous efforts to address these concerns, poor reproductive health outcomes persist. And so I wanted to turn for a moment to a reproductive justice model as a way of thinking about some of this. In the early 1990s, the term reproductive justice was coined by black health activists here in the U.S. as an alternative to the choice centered reproductive rights movement that only partially addressed the experiences and needs of black women. These activists have developed a vision of justice that responds to their diverse experiences of reproductive oppression. And so that language is used here as a base experience, oppression. And as one group puts it, reproductive justice will be achieved when women and girls have the economic, social, political power and resources to make healthy decisions about our bodies, sexuality, and reproduction for ourselves. Now, this framework has been adopted and adapted by dozens of groups across the U.S., and reproductive justice has become a tool in many ways, a tool of ethical analysis, and also the basis of a lot of activism around reproductive health. So the vision of reproductive justice is really broken into three parts, or three lenses or approaches, if you will. The first one is the one most of us are familiar with, is the reproductive health sort of framework or approach, which focuses on the inequities or disparities in health status and also in health care, right? So it identifies the central cause of poor reproductive health as a lack of services, and thus recommends, not surprisingly, more and better access to services as the solution. So this approach, for example, recommends improving health through securing more funding for health centers, attempting to expand Medicaid eligibility, and increasing promotora, or lay health advisor programs, for example. So that's really where I did most of my work when I was involved with health centers, is sort of this approach. Another approach is this reproductive rights approach, which understands a central cause of poor reproductive health to be a lack of protective legislation, so it's much more legal orientation, right? And weak enforcement of the laws that are in place. And thus, we have farmworker-specific legal services which try to address things like workplace discrimination, sexual exploitation, as well as promoting reproductive rights. So that's kind of another lens that people approach farmworker women's reproductive health through. Now, notice some similarities here. Both the reproductive health and rights focus on individuals, right? The needs of individuals with services for individuals. And both assume that more services are going to improve people's health. Now, the third sort of lens, if you will, or approach is what we also is called, somewhat confusingly, also reproductive justice. But this approach says that these legal and health approaches, while necessary, are actually insufficient to end reproductive oppression. That is, that these fundamental social inequalities that undergird poor health also have to be addressed. That we have to talk about poverty, we have to talk about racism, employment discrimination, and stigmatizing of immigrants. And that these things need to be named along with the work that we're doing otherwise. That these inequitable power arrangements are the sort of conditions for poor health in many cases. So how do you do that? Strategies they recommend are, in fact, building on women's leadership, so organizing and building women's leadership, and giving women organizing skills so that they can be leaders in their communities, active social agents of change. Now, these long-term strategies aren't a replacement for the reproductive health and legal strategies we're talking about, but it's a push for us to think about how we add this into the work that we're doing for longer-term change. So what does reproductive oppression look like for migrant farmworker women? Here's a couple of cartoons that actually go for all farmworkers, I think, not just migrant women, but women and men. So I would say here that migrant women's bodies and sexuality are regulated and controlled by low-wage agricultural work that has few benefits and where gender discrimination is common, by the second shift of domestic labor compounded by women's responsibility for the work of migration, that is, the packing up and setting up of temporary households, often several times in a season, on top of their paid labor, by a whole array of occupational hazards, from minor to life-threatening, that differentially affect women. For example, the lack of field sanitation, we are still talking about this. When I started working in migrant health in the 70s, I thought it was a 60s issue in the 70s, and now we're into the next century, and the lack of toilets and water in fields is still an issue, but certainly contributes to women's holding it or not emptying their bladders throughout the workday, so putting them at greater risk for urinary and kidney infections, particularly problematic for pregnant women, as we know. Women routinely mask their bodies in layers of clothing, including hats and bandanas, to avoid sexual attention and harassment. And actually, just last night on NPR, their online news, just started a two-part series on sexual assault and farmworker women, if you want to see something really up-to-date on this. So add to these conditions the inevitable chronic and sometimes acute exposure to multiple compounds of pesticides with unknown interactions, and farmworker women's reproductive health is likely far more compromised than we currently understand. These workplace realities challenge the commonly held belief, particularly people who aren't in agricultural areas, that agricultural work is somehow different than other work, and thus less in need of the kinds of labor and workplace safety standards that routinely protect other workers. Other U.S. policies control and regulate migrant lives. Trade agreements between the U.S. and other countries, especially Mexico, shape the flow of immigration. And immigration policies, including border enforcement, affect both the number of border crossers and the number that arrive alive. U.S. healthcare policies, as we know, severely limit healthcare services for low-income and immigrant communities. Furthermore, the U.S. is rife with powerful stereotypes and attitudes about immigration, gender, race, sexuality, and fertility that contribute to reproductive oppression. Migrant immigrants have long been stigmatized as a threat to the U.S., a threat to the economy, to public health, to public schools, to public welfare, and to the political and social stability of the nation as a whole. In public health in particular, xenophobia and racism have contributed to the characterization of Mexican immigrants as disease-carrying outsiders likely to infect presumably healthy citizens, and of immigrant Latinas as breeders and anchor baby makers and drains on the U.S. healthcare services. So, what does reproductive justice look like? The work that's being done actually by migrant farm worker women. Well, this is to say that migrant farm worker women have been involved in labor organizing since the 60s. And to address some concerns of theirs that weren't addressed in some of those groups, some women formed women's organizations, separate women's organizations. And in 1991, the first national women's meeting took place in San Antonio, Texas, and this had Latinas, African-American women, Hmong women, all sorts of women, where they focused on community organizing, leadership development, and specific farmworker-related health concerns. Maybe not surprisingly, there wasn't a lot of funding for this kind of thing. They wanted to keep it going, but it pretty much died out after another year. But soon after, a group of California farmworking women organized and formed a group that's now known as Líderes Campesinas, the largest and most active farmworker women's organization in the U.S., with 9 local committees across California. And echoing the reproductive justice vision, their mission is, and I quote, to develop leadership among campesinas so that they serve as agents of political, social, economic change in the farmworker community. And I should say, this group is not alone in the work that they do. And there's been sort of a recent revival of national organizing. And last fall and this past spring, dozens of farmworker women met, formed this new Alianza. It's actually called Alianza Nacional de Campesinas, to launch a new initiative dealing with women's farmworker health. So back to the young woman I talked about at the beginning, Luz. This is a note that she wrote. It's like, well, you know what my life has been like, drugs and everything you can think of. My other friends, they're into drugs and trouble with the law, are just like me. I know I won't want to stay here in this town, but I'll have to because I can't do nothing about it. Well, being able to do something about it is precisely the goal of both farmworker women's organizing and the reproductive justice movement. So just to conclude, I think there's 2 lessons for us in thinking about reproductive justice and farmworker health. And one is that along with the work we're doing in health services and in legal services, we have to think about doing some work with other social justice organizations who are trying to change those underlying conditions that contribute to this. So all sorts of groups you can imagine being in coalition with. That's one thing. And the other is to support farmworker women's leadership themselves in improving the health of their communities. So thank you for that. Questions, comments?
You mentioned quite a bit about community organizing and giving examples, but on the legislative side, what actions need to take place to actually transform policies that govern a lot of what takes place in the agriculture industry?
There's some work being done, and it's not women-specific for the most part, but farmworker-specific around agriculture, around trying to up workplace standards, safety standards, but around women
women's reproductive health in particular?
Because it's a combination of both addressing the industry overall and the reproductive rights, so there's like this intersection that's available. And my background is in politics, kind of coming in here and listening. So I'm just wondering from a legislative side, if saw a picture there of someone signing something, and I'm like, are there any actions that you would recommend that we undertake? I mean, community organizing is done to the point that it has to impact
reproductive rights then. Yeah. I mean, I think part of this model of reproductive justice is that you actually take the lead from people in the community who are, you know, doing the work. So I would say, for anyone you're interested in this, is to find people in your community and find out what they're already working on legislatively. I wish I had a great answer. There's not a lot happening nationally, you know, organizing around women's reproductive rights. I think more of it is happening level, level. Do you have ideas? I wish I had.
I'm out of California, so you know, we have a huge agriculture industry, and for me this was great. Thank you so much. I actually got a lot out of your presentation.
Great.
Good outreach to now.
Thank you.
I think that, but I would like to add, and it's actually, thank you so much for that presentation, but I think that we all need to be more conscientious and supportive of the immigration reform, because there's a complete comprehensive package that will include some of those issues that our Latino families are actually suffering now here. So I think if we look at it in detail, the document exists, it's a public document that, you know, hopefully it gets passed, but we don't know how it's not gonna go.
Right.
So let's hope and support the immigration reform.
Thank you for letting me.
And I know the group that I mentioned in California, a lot of their work is centered around violence. You know, immediately the harmful women's group, they've been dealing with violence in the families and community context, but it's not necessarily a policy change and a cultural work that they're doing in the community work, gender work.
Thank you.
We had a question here.
No, I was just going to say, I'm hoping that that happens. Exactly. Because I think, you know, without google.org and all of these things, is nobody takes on farm worker justice. And that should be part of a national, much more comprehensive movement, as opposed to just pockets of folks.
Right. Right. So just a last note I want to just say, this is actually just a little snippet of a much bigger paper that's been published, and if anybody wants a cite for that, I've got it up here. I can give it to you afterwards. Oh, it's right there, too. But I can give you a card with it on if you don't want to scribble that all down. So thank you.